to be American.
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. Did you know that there is a news organization dedicated solely to covering issues of voting rights? VoteBeat provides an innovative approach to journalism and democracy. Today, we are pleased to welcome Jessica Huseman, the editorial director of VoteBeat, a nonprofit newsroom that covers all things election-related, including a lot about the nuts and bolts aspects of how elections actually operate. Their weekly newsletter is indispensable. Jessica, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you. That was a fabulous introduction. I am flattered.
I try. So tell us a little bit about VoteBeat. How did it start? What does it do today?
VoteBeat was sort of an odd accidental idea that Elizabeth Green, who is the CEO of Civic News Company, which used to just be called ChalkBeat because that was their only news organization, and she ran ChalkBeat at the time, wanted to come up with another news organization. So ChalkBeat covers K-12 news. She wanted another beat, right? What else can we cover? The 2020 election was underway, and they decided to create a pop-up newsroom. And at that time, I wasn't involved, but when they decided to make it permanent, I came in as editorial director. And so now we are in Texas, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and we are currently hiring a reporter in Wisconsin. So if any Wisconsin people are listening and would like to apply for a job, it is open.
It sounds like a great opportunity. And so you have these reporters in these handful of states, and then you're sort of directing things from the national level. So should we think of VoteBeat as a national newsroom or a cluster of different news or, you know, news groups in each of these different states?
That's a really good question. I like to think of VoteBeat as a local newsroom that is sort of networked together. And so the philosophy really behind all of Civic News is that we can support more journalism if we centralize editing and fundraising and administrative stuff and let the journalists do their journalism. And so all of our journalists are based in the state that they cover. The editors are wherever, and we do the work that they need us to do when they need us to do it. So I'm typically in charge of projects, but that doesn't mean I'm a national projects editor. I just go between our five states when there's an investigation that a reporter needs assistance with.
So VoteBeat's the only newsroom that's dedicated solely to covering election law, essentially, and election legislation and voting rights. Why do you think that is? Why aren't more news organizations focusing their resources in the way that you all are?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and I think that I started covering this beat as an intern at ProPublica in 2016, and it was kind of an accident, right? They got some funding to do this huge project on election administration called Election Land. And they were like, oh, you run this now. And that was the introduction I had to election administration, right? Like there wasn't, this was not part of some grand plan. And so it's taken me that long to become confident enough in my knowledge of this space that I can direct a newsroom that covers that. And I think that that's really the answer. Like newsrooms don't do this because it requires such a large amount of specified knowledge. And newsrooms, as you might have seen, are sort of shedding employees like you would not believe. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of taking on a beat that requires this much sort of investment can be a little bit overwhelming. But that is part of the reason that VoteBeat's stories are Creative Commons licensed and anyone can publish them.
And you know, that's maybe the frustrating thing, too, is that, you know, this VoteBeat is something that affects all of us. You know, it's the sort of thing that the general public does need to understand, and yet these things can be so complicated. And so to that end, your reporting often covers the really nitty-gritty stuff of election administration. You talk about things like ERIC, which is a multi-state database for voter registration where states can share their lists and thereby help to update the voter registration lists. You talk about problems at the Election Assistance Commission, this organization, this federal agency that no one really knows about that's supposed to help states and counties run their elections. So how do you engage the public? How do you engage voters on what really sounds like inside baseball?
Yeah, you know, this is like the daily challenge that I face, right? It's like, how do I get people to care about an election that's not even happening until November, right? Like, that's how people think about elections. And so this has actually been sort of an interesting thing to explain internally in my company, because it's a K-12 education company and a voting company, right? K-12 education, you have a stagnant daily audience of kids going to school, or at least parents wishing their kids were in school. Hmm. Voting happens like for people once every 2 or every 4 years. So it's...
Well, hopefully they're participating in the primaries too. So hopefully. Maybe a couple times during the year.
couple of times a year. But like if we're talking about your average American participating in this, you know, so it's not something that people have on their mind all the time. So we really do have to tap into a couple of things. So one, we have to tell the stories as if we are talking to someone who doesn't know anything about voting. We have to make them approachable. But then also, there are stories that really aren't approachable and cannot become approachable, and they're not really intended for Joe voter, right? They are intended for policymakers who are thinking about this. They're intended for election administrators. Because what we realized as we were sort of standing up VoteBeat was that not only are voters underserved in terms of their ability to share and find good information about the voting process, so are election administrators, and so are people in the space themselves and legislators who would make better decisions about the legislation that they pass given better information. And so we're sort of seeking to fill the gap that the public has, but also the gap that people who are making decisions about this every day in a way that most voters are not sort of see and engage with on a daily basis.
Yeah, I find that really frustrating sometimes when I speak to legislators who think they know about election administration, and, you know, they're theory as well. I ran in an election and I won. So and I have to gently tell them running for election doesn't mean you know how to run an election.
Right. And I think that you know, you would hear, and I'm sure that you, everybody who's listening to this knows a teacher, right? And it's the same thing that somebody would say if they tried to give them teaching advice and they were like, oh, I was once a student, right? Like, just because you were a student and maybe even a good one doesn't necessarily mean you can teach. And so it's just a very different perspective.
Yeah. Now, you focus a lot also on county clerks, the people who are at the front lines of running elections. Maybe this is the same question, but I think it's important to hear again. You know, why do you focus on these individuals, and how do we convince the public to care about the county clerk as much as they care about the president?
This is among my top issues in life, I think. So the county clerk is such an important figure, and it has so much influence over the way that most people engage in municipal government, right? Because not only do they manage elections, they also manage like titles and licenses. Like there are a lot of things that these folks do. They provide a lot of services to the county. And so I think that the lack of coverage of them has both made it easier for them to get away with sort of like not advancing their processes as quickly as they otherwise would if they were better in the spotlight. But it has also meant that they don't have access to good information, because I think that people sort of underestimate how much information clerks get from local media, or how much information clerks get from the media alerting them to a problem. And local media is going away, right? And so we're both sort of letting those offices go without coverage, and also not providing the coverage those offices need in order to really be responsive to the public interest. And so that I think is a really important hole to fill. And I'm hopeful that we are at least trying to do that.
Yeah. And that's one of the themes of this show, right, is to shed a light for the public on how these things actually work on the ground level, because that's where it actually has the biggest influence. So you said on a PBS interview that there's a fine line between advocating for change and giving people the impression that the system is too flawed so that they don't participate at all. Let's listen in.
There is a fine line between very loudly advocating for change and then going so far that you sort of push people over to thinking that there's no point and there's no point in engaging with the system at all.
All right, so how do we strike that balance?
I think it's a hard balance to strike. It's true. I think that what I would advocate is that people take a solutions-oriented approach to criticizing a system, right? I think what we're seeing a lot of is big, broad criticisms of systems that ultimately have no solutions because the problems they're pointing out are sort of inherent to the systems themselves, right? Like, we assume a certain amount of risk depending on which voting method we choose, but that may come with more or less access. And that's sort of a cost-benefit analysis that everyone has to do. And so I think that the people who get lost in this discussion where people are advocating for change, advocating for change, advocating for change, are the people who just like stop being able to access voting or stop being able to want to access voting because they can't sort of see a solution, right? So Republicans are agitating against vote by mail. That's sort of a disagreement within the party. I think we all saw in the 2020 election, and especially in the runoff in Georgia, how influential that the choice to not participate in vote by mail was, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic. There weren't a lot of other options. There weren't good solutions to the problems that they were pointing out because the problems weren't real. And so they just chose not to participate. And so at some point, the advocacy tips over into people feeling like the system is just not workable and won't serve their needs. And so they opt out of participating altogether, or they're left with very few opportunities to participate. And so they can't.
And of course, that, you know, is a problem for democracy, whichever side it's affecting, you know, whichever party's supporters are not coming out to vote. And that leads me to my next question. So, you know, the head of one of our two major political parties seems to be rejecting democracy itself in many ways. And, you know, I find it really important in my own scholarship and advocacy to remain nonpartisan. I know that journalists do as well, right? They're really trying hard to be an independent voice of transparency and to be nonpartisan. And yet you've got Donald Trump attacking democracy, you know, promoting the myth of voter fraud, as you already mentioned, encouraging his supporters not to use mail-in voting during the pandemic, and of course, refusing to accept election results before any votes are cast. So how do journalists handle this difficulty of covering, one of the two major political party candidates in a way that's fair, but also in a way that protects democracy?
Yeah, so I think that journalists need to recognize that, at least in the United States, our role in democracy is pretty well defined historically, right? Like, the reason that freedom of the press is written into the Bill of Rights is because the founders envisioned that we would do something to further democracy, right? Like, we would help keep the voting public engaged and apprised of what was going on so that they could knowledgeably vote, right? And so that assumes that people should be able to vote, right? And it also assumes that they should be able to do so with appropriate and like true information. And so I think that if there are two candidates and one is saying a lot of not true things and the other one isn't saying as many untrue things, then the weight of stories should reflect that difference. And so, you know, I think that it should be seen as less the media making a call on what to cover and more the media making sure that the information on balance that people are receiving has been appropriately checked such that people can participate as knowledgeable voters.
And I guess that means that there shouldn't be a both sides of every story, right? That perhaps the media, you know, too much both sides things in 2016 and failed to call out some of the blatant lies in that way. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I do. I think it's a fair assessment. And I think that there were a lot of media companies that sort of took a step back from going as far as they could on quickly and very sort of like aggressively debunking things that he said early on, especially when he was running for president that first time. I think it was so unique to be confronted with a candidate that was saying those things that the media didn't know what to do, but we don't have that excuse anymore. Like, we know what we're getting ourselves into here.
Yeah. So are you optimistic about voting and elections and 2024, or not so much?
I am more optimistic than not. Is that an appropriate answer to this question? I think I'm really optimistic about quite a lot of things. I think that we're in at least as good of a place, or the best place we have ever been in terms of election technology and security. And, you know, I think that the public is sort of apprised to these issues, and the county clerks are sort of trained in communicating with the public and the media in a way that they weren't even in 2020. And that will serve sort of the best interests of the public. I am sort of concerned about the turnover and all of the new folks that will be running elections sometime, some of them for the very first time in 2024. So we're in a moment of real transition, but I don't see any major red flags pointing me to thinking a disaster is on the horizon at this stage.
Yeah. And, you know, I called this show Democracy Optimist, both in terms of a description of how I often feel, but also an aspiration. And I think I hear that a little bit in your answer. So my last question is, what is the one thing you think listeners can do to protect and support democracy? We're already going to talk about signing up for the Vote Beat newsletter. So beyond that, what's the one thing that that listeners can do to support democracy?
Go be a poll worker. I say this hundreds of times a year, but I think my mom, for example, had a lot of the same light sort of doubts as to sort of how the system worked, what went into it, whether or not voter fraud was real. She became a poll worker. She got all of her questions answered in a day. She's a very active participant in the Dallas County Elections Department now, which is like among my greatest successes. But I think that, like, for people who have questions about this, for people who want to support election administrators who they're worried might be getting harassed or don't have enough resources, for people who are concerned that their county isn't doing a good enough job, like, the solution to all of those problems is to just be a poll worker and do it yourself. And that will sort of lighten the load on everyone.
Yeah. You know, is it the famous quote from Tip O'Neill, all politics are local? I think the message here is all elections are local. Jessica Huseman from Vote Beat. Make sure you check out the resources that Vote Beat has. This was such a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Josh, on the matter of optimism, this is Democracy Optimist, after all. And on that matter, about the 2024 elections and what shape democracy will actually be in after November the 5th, Jessica Huseman seemed to be cautiously optimistic. And I think a lot of us feel that way right now. Should we?
I think so. I mean, that's how I feel. You know, we call this Democracy Optimist. And, you know, even when you and I were talking about this series and thinking, is that too rosy of a name? But I think we need to be optimistic, because otherwise the answer might be to throw up our hands and think, you know, we can't do anything. The system is, you know, essentially rigged. Although we also need to be cognizant of the challenges that democracy faces. One reason I'm optimistic is the amount of attention that's being paid to these issues. The number of places that are beefing up their voting rights reporting, the number of people who are looking critically at the way democracy works, and the number of people who are clamoring for actual information, for the real truth about how these things operate. So, yes, you know, I'm not naive about the challenges that democracy faces, especially as we talked about with Jessica, with, you know, one of the two major presidential candidates, you know, really challenging democracy itself. And that's not a partisan statement, of course. It's the reality of the sorts of things that one candidate has said. But we need to be optimistic about what's possible while recognizing the challenges, which I think what Jessica was saying as well.
And, you know, I'm thinking if you're concerned that the elections are rigged, one way to get to the bottom of that is to get involved, right? I mean, isn't there, for example, a real shortage of poll workers?
Yeah. And there really is, especially, you know, after the COVID-19 pandemic, with a lot of the poll workers decided not to show up. Certainly, poll workers tend to skew on the older side. And so many of these individuals have not wanted to do it. Now, there's also threats against election officials and poll workers, unfortunately. But the way to respond to that is to not let those who are threatening people win, but to double down in our efforts. You know, democracy's always been about the people taking a stand. We're at an inflection point right now that we all need to do that.
Well, let me ask you to, as we do in each segment here, to single out an election law that all of us ought to be aware of.
So in our conversation with Jessica, we mentioned the Election Assistance Commission, which is a federal agency that exists to help states and localities run their elections. How did this come about? Well, after the Bush v. Gore debacle in 2000, you recall hanging chads and the like in Florida, Congress passed a law, the Help America Vote Act of 2002, to address the problems. And the law did a lot of things. For example, it says that if you're voting in a federal election and you show up to the polls and your name is not on the voter rolls or you don't have the right ID that state law requires, you can't be turned away. Instead, election officials must offer you a provisional ballot, which is basically a ballot that's set aside, and then the election officials determine after Election Day whether that ballot should count. Well, part of that law, the Help America Vote Act, was to create this new agency, the Election Assistance Commission, which helps administer federal funds and gives funds to states to run their elections. Now, the makeup of the commission is kind of interesting. There are four commissioners, two appointed by Democrats and two appointed by Republicans. Sounds great, right? We have some bipartisanship, but you can probably see the problems when we get to the hot button issues. The commission often deadlocks 2-2. In fact, for a while, the commission literally had zero members because no one was confirmed to the positions. So the staff of the commission was basically running the show. Right now, there's some turmoil that VoteBeat has covered. The commission fired its executive director recently, and that person had only been in the role for about a year. The agency doesn't have a permanent general counsel either. So right now, it's the chief information security officer filling in as the executive director. Of course, not great as we enter in an election year. And how did I know about any of this? Because I read a story from VoteBeat.
Well, you know, it's always good to have one of these in your hip pocket when you get into a conversation with friends and family about politics or about the elections and so forth. And that's to have a really good, fun election fact on hand. Can you give us one?
Yeah, and this one's going to relate to something I hear a lot. And so this gets into the myth-busting aspect of our conversations. There's been a big push to require hand counting of ballots instead of having machines do it. You hear this a lot. No, you can't trust the machines. We need to count the ballots by hand after they are cast. But most election experts will tell you that hand counting of ballots is a really bad idea. Why? Because humans aren't very good at rote activities like counting millions of ballots in a short time period. So some researchers have looked into this. One experiment from Rice University asked 40 undergrads to count ballots, and each ballot had 27 political races on it, which is not that absurd in a presidential election year when you have all of the down ballot races. And the undergrads only had to count 120 total ballots. And then they measured how accurate they were 58% of the time. 58% of the ballots were fully accurately counted. Machines can do that much better. Multiply that by thousands, and you can start seeing the problems of having full hand counting of ballots. So experts agree that machine counting with paper ballots so that there's a careful recount possibility if we need to recount a certain subset of the ballots is the best election practice.
Well, I know you always end your interviews with this question. It's a good one, but I'd like to get Josh Douglas's one thing we can do to support democracy.
VoteBeat has weekly newsletters, as I mentioned in the interview with Jessica Huseman. So go ahead and sign up. They come in every Saturday morning is their kind of national newsletter. But interestingly, they also have state-specific newsletters every other week for right now, Arizona, Texas, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So if you're in one of those states or you're interested, because of course, a lot of those states are a hot button states or swing states, go to votebeat.org. You can learn a lot of information. And the nice thing is it's really accessible to everyday voters.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.